Good morning again. Good morning. We as elders of the church, there's kind of two areas that we focus on. One is prayer, and I was very encouraged by Chick's prayer. And each time we meet as elders, we pray for you guys, often for the things you share with us and often for things that we just are felt led to. The other thing we do is we focus on the teaching of the Word, and that's what we're here to do today. Because there's things in life that are important to you. You often find that over the holidays. Over the holidays, you go back and there's certain patterns and traditions in life that you do, things that you do because they're important. So here at Hope Community Church, learning more about our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is important to us. So each year, from Christmas till about Easter, we study the life of Jesus Christ. We rotate through different gospels, with different parts of his life, but the life of Jesus Christ and who he was and what he means to us is something we've done year over year over year for many years now. This year, we'll be looking specifically at the early years of Jesus' ministry as found in the Gospel of Mark. We'll be looking at chapters 3, 4, and 5, and we're going to focus on those things that show us things that are always true about who Jesus is. Always true. Now, the Gospel of Mark, as you remember, is focused on who Jesus is anyway. And in fact, the Gospel of Mark starts out saying the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. So in each of the messages, we're going to review who is Jesus and what's true about him, what's something that's true about him. Now, speaking of things that are true, I have little things I want to show you here that come from the physical world, okay? So, for example, if I let go of this, where will it go?
Down.
Good, okay. So that's one thing that we know is always true. Now, I know there's a few smart alecks out there thinking in a gravity-free zone and things like that, but just work with me, okay, on the general principles, okay? Those of you can confess that later. We have time for confession later. Now, I have two objects here, two balls. Now, if I drop them, which one will hit the ground first? Now, some of you were like, wow, the big one didn't go first. Okay, but the way the things work in our physical world, they always both go down at the same time. Now, typically they use this with a feather and a bowling ball, but there's some friction and wind involved in that. But for just for today. Now, I have something a little more trickier for those of you a little more advanced. Most of you are thinking, okay, that's pretty simple. Now, let's pretend that I'm on an airplane, okay? And I often do. I travel for work, as many of you know. And in the airplane, I have my little ball again. Now, the airplane is starting to take off. Now, what I'm going to do while I'm in the airplane is I'm going to throw the ball up. The airplane is moving this way. I'm going to throw the ball up. Where should the ball go? Behind me, right? So if I throw the ball up while I'm moving, it actually comes right back down to me. So why is that the case? Because we're all moving, okay? And so actually, if you look at the picture up here on the screen, oops, I'm stuck here. What happens is if you look from the outside of the airplane, this is actually what you will see. You'll actually see the ball moving. Now, some of you are like, okay, this is way too deep for me, okay? Let's go back to just the drop part, okay? But that's really, as we look at this series about Jesus as always, there's going to be things that we're going to discover together. Some of them may be quite basic that you've never seen about Jesus before, never considered. Some of them are going to be a little more intermediate, like when we drop the two. And other ones are going to be quite complex. And it really requires your heart to be opened up and your mind to be opened up to understand more of things that are happening in Jesus' life. So that's what's going to happen in these upcoming weeks. And our sermon today and our message today is focused on one thing about Jesus. It's the thing that actually is the most common. And many of you remember this from Peter Pan. Now, I would really oblige Chick to help me. Typically, I am not a singer, okay? But basically, as you remember, we choose a leader, follow the leader. And how does it go, right? Da-dum, da-dum. Come on, help me out. Peter Pan fans, come on, where's my Disney fans? Following the leader, the leader, the leader, right? And the leader, wherever he may go, right? So why is it that we are just fascinated by following the leader? How many of you have played follow the leader, right? Growing up, right? Your parents probably played follow the leader. Your grandparents probably played follow the leader. Your great-grandparents probably played follow the leader. This is not a new game, okay? It just was epitomized in Peter Pan. So why is it that we like that game? Why do we participate in that game? So my premise is that God has wired us to be followers, and we will follow something. Now, obviously, many of us like to lead too, because you can't wait to do what they do so you can get in the front. And we'll talk about that a little bit later today as we look at the crowd. But this game is just something that we do. So whether we're at church, whether we're in sports, any activity we're in, there are always leaders. We're always surrounded by leaders in different places that we are. And each day, we're faced with making the choice, are we going to follow the leader or not? So what I want to do is I want to turn our attention to the passage that we're going to look at today. It's actually found in Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 19. Now next week, Chick's going to continue on the subsequent verses, and he's going to see how Jesus is always focused. He's focused on God's desires and God's designs, despite what happens in his family and his circumstances. But this week, we're focused on following Jesus. Jesus is always to be followed. So if you would just follow along with me, starting in verse 7. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard about all he was doing, many people came from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, the regions across the Jordan, and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told the disciples to have a small boat ready for him, to keep the people from crowding him, for he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. Jesus appoints the 12 as next. Jesus went up to the mountainside, and he called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. These are the 12 he appointed: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter; James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder; Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Now what we're going to do is we're going to walk through these two sections of verses, the first section being 7 through 12 and the last one being 13 through 19, and we're going to understand just a few things of what's happening there and then see how we can apply them to our lives today. So starting with verses 7 through 12, we see that Jesus is basically moving to the other side of the lake so he could address a multitude of people who were coming at him. His fame had spread, and then what had happened is he basically wanted to get back because of all the things that were coming at him with these people. So we have a map up here that shows this area and where he was at. So he was up in Galilee, and people were coming basically from the north, from the south, and a bit from the what we would call the west. So they were all converging on him. Probably the best example I can give us from our recent news here is when Pope Francis came here to Philadelphia, right? So we had people coming from Allentown, Delaware, Princeton, Lancaster. You've even thought you had to rent out your house for the week because they were coming from all four corners of the globe. But if you think about what happened when Francis came, he sat there, and then people from all over came around him. And we actually had to find a place where he could speak so most people could hear him. So that's what's happening here. Jesus is setting himself up on the side of the lake so he could address the multitude of people who were accompanying him. Now, did you ever go to a large event, like a concert or whatever, and they're like, okay, who's from Jersey? Yay, Jersey. Okay, who's from Philadelphia? And that's what's happening here. This crowd, they're really in pockets from where they're from. So they came as groups, and they were kind of with all of their posse or their homies in this section. So this is the section from West Philly, this is from Fishtown, and this is from the Northeast, and this is how they're set up. So they all have different sets of expectations because each of those areas had heard and seen different things about Jesus that drew them here today. So in the same way you go to maybe a concert and there's a certain song that really resonates with you, you just can't wait till he's going to sing it. So that's what's happening here. There's basically groups of people from different areas who are anticipating Jesus to basically perform for them, do something on their behalf. Now, what's interesting is that we see in verses 9 and 10, the crowd got so big that basically they were pressing in against him and about to crush him. And what they said is that people were just even wanting to touch him. And we remember the story of the sick woman who had faith that if she could only just touch him, that she would be healed. That's the type of power that was emanating from him at this time. So what he did is he basically asked his disciples to get him in a small little boat and push him out into the water so basically the people couldn't come at him. So, and also he could basically address them in a wider sense. Now in verses 11 and 12, we see that people who were possessed with evil spirits even were being affected by him. So basically every type of person you can imagine was there. And what he was telling them was that not to say who he was. It wasn't the time yet. Now, you might remember in Matthew chapter 4 that the leader of the evil spirits, Satan, what did he challenge Jesus? He said to Jesus in Matthew 4, verse 3, he said, if you are what? The Son of God. So even Satan, back earlier in Jesus' ministry, knew who he was. And these evil spirits were the same way. They were basically identifying Jesus at that point in time as the Son of God. Now, also early in Mark chapter 1, we see in verses 21 through 28, the story of Jesus driving out an evil spirit from a man. And people remarking how Jesus even gives orders to the evil spirits on what to do. And later in Mark chapter 1, verse 34, it explains how Jesus would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Now, basically, we see this exciting scene, right? So Jesus is teaching, he's healing, he's commanding evil spirits, and it's pretty much a madhouse. I mean, it's a festival of sorts. And then that's where the scene changes. And this is really what I love about these passages and how they're side by side with each other. In verse 13, we see Jesus goes up to a mountainside to get away from the crowds. He withdrew. And earlier in Mark and some of the other passages in his early ministry, we see him withdrawing. This is a pattern that he was going to have. He was going to come away with his close family, these men who he called to be part to join with him. And if you remember in Luke chapter 6, verse 12, what did he do the whole night before he was going to call these men? He prayed. He spent the whole night praying so that way he would know to have the wisdom and the confidence of who he was going to select. Now, he summoned those people to himself that he wanted. So this wasn't a general call, hey, anybody wants to come along? But this was people that he individually selected. He picked him, and he picked him, and he picked him, and he picked him. And he called them to do specific things, to have a role. Now, the role that he had for them is called apostles. Now, before we kind of unpack that, what's interesting is that how many men did he pick? It's got 12. Now, do we think that was a coincidence? No. In fact, 12 is amazing because there was 12 tribes of Israel before. So God, when he first formed the nation of Israel, he set them up in 12 tribes. And here again, God has a plan and it involves 12 men representing things. In fact, we see later in Jesus' ministry in Luke 22, how the apostles are prophesied how they are going to be the judges over these tribes in the New World Order. We find the tribes and apostles associated together in the book of Revelation in the structure of the New Jerusalem. So God had a design from the beginning, and 12 was an interesting number. Now, there's a few other things I want to bring to mind on this 12 thing, and I want to not digress too far, but what's neat is in Mark chapter 6, which is just beyond our passage that we're going to study, Jesus feeds the 5,000. Does anyone remember how many baskets of bread and fish were left over? 12. Now, near the end of Jesus' life, as he's being arrested in Matthew 26, we see that Peter reaches for a sword, cuts off the guy's ear, and what is Jesus' response to him? He says, put back your sword in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put my disposal? How many legions of angels? 12 legions of angels. So this phrase, just in the book of Mark alone, the 12 is used over a dozen times. And I recommend on your own to do a study of that, to see, okay, there's nothing mystical or magical about 12, but definitely God had a design. I mean, if you think about designs, right, how many of you are bowlers, right? So ironically, the bowling pins, there's 10 of them, they all set up and you knock them down. There's just designs to how things work in the physical world. And the same thing we did with these balls. God has designs in the spiritual world, and the calling of these 12 men, the 12, not the dirty dozen or anything like that, the 12, this is what he has in mind, that he has a mission for them to accomplish as well. Now, out of this group of disciples that came to him, Jesus chose them for a special relationship, something special. Now, how many of you growing up had a front door and a back door to your house? Yes? Now, how many of you did only people who knew you go to the back door? Yes? Yes. I grew up in that type of house. So if anybody's knocking on the front door, who are they? Salespeople, right? Jehovah's Witnesses, right? I mean, people who you know, okay, you don't really want to let into your house because they're not part of, they don't know you. They don't have this special relationship with you. And that's what Jesus was doing. If you look back to the large crowds, they were knocking on his front door. They wanted something. They didn't have this relationship with him. They didn't have this calling, this commitment, this commission. But the 12 were back door. They knew to come around the back, that they were welcome there, that they could come into the back door and they could come into the house, and this is what he was going to do, spend time with them. They were going to be apostles. And even among the people who actually were true followers of him, there was disciples and apostles. Now, disciples were people who began their training and they were learning from their teacher. Apostles were people who actually would represent the teacher, almost as a proxy. And they had the full authority of that teacher. So these were people, not only were the disciples, but among the disciples, these were 12 men that he set aside to give them the authority and the power to act on his behalf. He was going to send them out. It almost is the idea of like a delegate or an ambassador. So an ambassador of our country, they basically represent our country and the country where they live, and they have the authority on behalf of our country to act and do certain things. So that's a good way to think about just the role here that the apostles had. Now, what's great about these apostles is we're now going to be introduced to them. So how many people watch television series that have characters involved? So why don't you share with somebody nearby one of your favorite television series that maybe you're in the middle of or you like to look forward to starting up again that has a set of characters. And trust me, I know you have one, okay? Okay, because I just read a statistic that said that the average person watches more TV, enough TV in a month, that if we replace that, we could actually read the entire Bible. So we all are watching TV, okay? So, and I'm among them, okay? So my wife and I like several series, and they have characters in them. So what's interesting is that when you have a television series that has a set of characters, we're drawn in by those characters. We want to root for them, or we want to root against, we want to hate some of them, we want to root for some of them, right? Any ones that are kind of just ancillary, they don't really draw our attention at all. So what's neat is that Jesus has chosen here 12 men to serve by him side by side, and they've got some unique real-life characteristics that I want to talk about in the end because they're kind of representative of us. But what I want to do now is introduce you to them as they're listed in sequential order, give you a little snippet about them, and then we do an application point. I want to kind of tell you a little more about them and what happened to them and what they're like to just help resonate with you in your own journey with Christ. So the first one, Simon, to whom he also gave the name Peter. Okay, so basically, Simon used to catch fish. Peter means rock. And basically, Jesus is going to form his church. It says in Matthew 6:18, I'm going to use him as a rock to build on. Now, many of you may know, I mean, hundreds of things about this man, Peter, because he is basically the main character out of all of them. I mean, we have Peter, James, and John. We're going to get to James and John here in a second. But that three are kind of the main characters. So if we were doing a television series, these are the guys who are eligible for the actor, right, the best actor award. Okay, these would guys be the main actors in the play. And what's interesting about Simon Peter is that whenever he was acting out of the flesh, Jesus would refer to him as what? Simon. And whenever he was doing something in God's spirit and honoring God, he would refer to as Peter. Now, I mentioned, you know, we could do a multiple sermon series just on Peter alone. But moving forward, we have James and John, the sons of Zebedee. Now, what was neat about them is they were very ready to give their own opinions in a loud, angry way. So he called them the sons of thunder. Now, this term thunder is very interesting. It's only used in two other places in the New Testament, and both of them are in the book of Revelation. And one of them is in Revelation chapter 6, where John has a vision. The Lamb opens up the first seal, and he hears one of the four living creatures saying, a voice like thunder, come! And then the other one is in Revelation chapter 15, where John sees the vision of the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion and heard a voice from heaven, like the many sounds of waters and the sound of loud thunder. So, I mean, these guys, I mean, if you think Peter was boisterous, I mean, these guys were basically probably didn't need to have any trouble projecting their voice, but more importantly, they were resolved. They were persistent. They were what we would call politely almost stubborn. So they were very, in fact, what will happen is that we learn that James was so bold and so stubborn, he was actually the first one who got killed on behalf of his faith. We see that in Acts chapter 12. And then also John was so stubborn, he was the one who lived the longest. He just outlasted everybody. So he was just going to stick it out. Now, then we move forward to this next group, okay? We have Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, and another James, Thaddeus, and another Simon. We don't know a lot about, you know, we know different parts of them. Andrew was Simon Peter's brother. Philip was a friend of theirs. Bartholomew was a friend of Philip's, also known by Nathaniel.
Matthew, we learned in the previous chapter of Mark, was this tax collector named Levi, who Jesus called to follow him. Thomas was a follower who was obviously famous for his fears and his doubts. The other, James, Thaddeus, and Simon, there's not a lot of known about those three. James was known as the son of Alphaeus, almost James the Lesser, and they weren't sure if he was shorter or younger. I'm going to prefer younger for his case. Thaddeus is a name that they really refers to kind of the youngest kid in the family, almost like baby. But he was also known as Judas, the son of James, so sometimes there's two Judases. And then the other Simon was actually referred to as Simon the Zealot. And Zealot was really kind of a group of people who wanted to force the Romans out of government. So there's 12 guys here, all forming this team or really a family that Jesus is going to set up. These are going to be his brothers in Christ. Now, in verse 19, unfortunately, we have Judas Iscariot, who Mark actually tags here as the one who betrayed him. And we see him really as the greatest tragedy in human history. So these 12 are ones that, like I said, I want to kind of talk about in a few minutes, just about what can we learn from their characteristics and who they were. But before we do that, I just kind of want to go back to the two sets of people. We've got the crowd, and we've got the apostles. What can we learn from these two sets as kind of we do some comparison? So what I want to do is very similar to some of the things that have been shared here, either through prayer or other things. I want to kind of do this in a New Year's resolution format and just say we will first resolve. And the first thing we're going to do is to be real in our following of Jesus. When we look at the crowds, before we kind of distance ourselves and say, oh, well, we wouldn't be like that, right? What I want to ask is how many people have been disappointed with how things have gone over the holidays? How many people are frustrated about maybe some things that they got or didn't get, or with relationships that they ran into with people? So as we look at these crowds and the things that they wanted from Jesus, you know, they wanted good possessions, good relationships, good health. We too quickly kind of dispel them as if they were just full of bad motives. But really what they were is they're people who really wanted a relationship of convenience with Jesus. As he was useful to them, he would be in their life. Almost like a co-pilot of sorts. You know, you can be in here with me and we'll go together, Jesus, as long as we're going in the direction I'm comfortable we're headed. So how many of you are good passengers in the car? Okay, I am not. My wife is attesting to this in the back there. So realistically, a car is designed to be driven by one person. In the same way, as we follow Christ, our lives are designed to be driven or directed by one person. And that's either going to be us or it's going to be him. In fact, sometimes when Jesus wants to take control of our lives and lead our lives, there's a word that was used here when he called these apostles, when we look at them as in contrast. The word is summons. Now, when I say the word summons, what comes to your mind? Jury duty, exactly, that's right. And that's kind of what we sometimes feel like, right? We feel like if Jesus is going to call me and I'm going to have to follow him, it's almost like jury duty. And what do we typically do with jury duty? We try to get out of it, right? I mean, that's what we come up with some good stories, right? So there's lots of good stories that oftentimes our hearts are inclined to do because it's inconvenient to follow Jesus, it's frustrating to follow Jesus, and I don't understand why in the world I would want to do it. So we try to get out of it. And so I began to unpack my own heart and say, why do I have those feelings sometimes? Why do I feel that it's more of a burden than a blessing? I realized that me and many of us, it's because we either don't know some things very well about Jesus, or the things that we do know frighten us. So let me talk about first our fears. And what is it that you're afraid of Jesus? When you follow somebody, you kind of have to, particularly with when you follow the leader, right? You got to be comfortable where they're going to go and how they're going to do it. And if they go and jump off something or do something, you're not comfortable. You're like, I'm not doing that. I'm done. You know, there's only so far I'm going to go here with this follow the leader game. There's certain things I will and won't do. And that's oftentimes how we bring our relationship with Jesus. We're like, okay, I'm comfortable, Jesus, if we're going to go this far. But, you know, I don't want I don't want any problems at work, you know, if I follow you. I don't want my marriage to be more complicated if I'm following after you with a stronger heart and my husband or wife isn't. I don't want to basically follow after you and then have more trouble with my kids. I'd rather just appease them rather than worry about their personal holiness. So I'm afraid. And really, sometimes I'm afraid it's not going to work out. that it's not worth it in the end. And that's what happened here. It's almost like, have you ever gone to, got an opportunity? We get phone calls like this all the time. You've won a vacation to the Bahamas, right? And all I have to do is show up for the presentation, right? And I have to sit through the presentation a couple hours, and then I finally get what I want. And so oftentimes we bring that mentality, that timeshare mentality, our relationship with Jesus. We just need to endure a few things he wants us to do in order for him to give us the good things in our life that we really want. It's almost an exchange, some sort of, we're pressured into doing something we're not so comfortable doing in order to get what we want from him. And that's not the design here. So that's really where we get ignorant of his calling. What he wants from us is very clear. He wants everything. He wants total control of your life. He wants no corner, no area of your life that doesn't belong to him. Isn't in full submission, full alignment, full under his direction. And if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will, because it scares me. But what I will tell you is what's more scary for me is when I'm outside of his direction and protection, because I've screwed it up a lot. And those of us who have walked with him for a period of time know that sense of just what it's like to wander away and not be under his tutelage, not be underneath following his leadership. And what do we end up doing? We end up messing stuff up, and we end up coming back to him. So as we think about this idea of following Jesus and being real in how we do that, I just want you to think about the crowds and the apostles. Tradition tells us that Peter was forced to witness the crucifixion of his wife, and he also was crucified, but he wasn't willing to do it the regular way. He went upside down because he felt unworthy to die as Jesus died. James, I mentioned, was the first one to be martyred. John was the last to die. Tradition tells us that Andrew later preached in certain areas and was crucified on an X-shaped cross that we often see today as St. Andrew's cross. Matthew lived in Jerusalem for about 15 more years after Jesus' resurrection and ministered in Persia, Ethiopia, where he was apparently stabbed to death because of his faith. James, the son of Alphaeus, preached the gospel also in Persia and was crucified there. Traditions say that Thaddeus ministered the gospel in Syria and was eventually martyred and beaten to death with a club. Simon the Zealot, on and on and on I could go with these men. So when Jesus says, come, follow me, be with me, he's talking about a real commitment where we're forced to look at our hearts. And as we look at 2016, as we talk about, there's two things I just want you to look at over this next week. One is your calendar, and the other one is your wallet. The calendar and the wallet give the window to your heart. How I spend my time and how I spend my money really show me what's going on inside my heart. And I know in my own life, there's times where I'm really looking forward to going something and doing something, and Jesus brings what we would call politely an interruption. Now, at that moment, I have a choice to make. Am I going to follow this thing that he's allowed to come in my life, or am I going to basically avoid it at all costs and keep going with the direction and pattern I want to do for that day? So my calendar shows that, and the same thing with my wallet shows me, where do I spend my money? How do I spend my time? Those are the things that give me a window. And when Jesus says, come and follow me, he wants your full calendar and your full wallet. Those are the things that he wants from me. And I'll tell you, as I've given him my calendar and I've given him my wallet, he's been nothing but giving me that guidance and direction, and more importantly, the peace of heart that comes that passes all understanding. Now, the second thing we want to do is we want to resolve to be with him as we follow him. So Jesus just doesn't say, hey, I want you to start following all my rules and regulations. And that's, again, where we see the difference between the crowds and the apostles. The crowds were seeking to receive from Jesus some things so they could go on with their merry way, but more importantly, they weren't interested in spending time with him. They wanted to get what they need and move on. So how many of you have caller ID? And when certain people call, which ones do you pick up and which ones do you not? So I'm not asking you to answer that question right now, okay? But we realize that typically the people whose calls we don't pick up are people who want something from us. And the relationship we have with them is based upon something that they're expecting from us rather than some sort of intimacy or love that we experience with them. So as we look at our own relationship with Jesus, is it one that we just want to be with him? Does he feel that we just want to be with him? So I'll give you a simple example. As many of you know, we've adopted a young boy, about 3 years old, and he just loves to come up and say, Dad, what are you doing? Dad, And he just holds on to my arm. It's just like, and he just wants to be with me. That's all he wants to do. He wants to follow me around. Now, obviously, it slows me down, and you try to set the table with a three-year-old, okay? Have any of you done that before, okay? It doesn't get done very quickly, right? So if you try to do the laundry with a three-year-old, you try to do anything with a three-year-old, you know, but what's neat is that this is where the heart of God, and when Jesus asked us to join with him, clearly Jesus could get God's agenda done much faster without us tagging along. But he asked these 12 men to come along and watch him and follow him and then follow in his paths. And that's God's heart for us. He wants us to participate in what he's doing. Now, what's neat is that, you know, like, we don't have to. Like, this is optional. Like, he's going to get it done anyway. He doesn't need us to get his agenda done. But he allows us to participate with him. And that was what was neat, is when Jesus called him, he said, be with me. Be with me. See how I do things. And I remember, you know, this whole idea of wanting to be with somebody. Obviously, when I was a young boy, many of us wanted to be with our parents, one of our parents. And he was a teenager. How many of us as a teenager had a crush on a Hollywood star, okay? Yes? Okay. Charlie's Angels, Jacqueline Smith, right here, okay? Okay. And I would do anything for Jacqueline Smith. If she just called me up, I would do anything for her, right? So as we look at the new year and this idea of falling in love with Jesus and following after him, this is the type of be with he wants. He wants me to be with. Now, obviously, I was just enamored with her physical beauty. But the neat thing about Christ is, as we sang here today, we're just enamored with who he is. And he wants us to spend time with him, and he wants us to just want to be with him and do things together with him and learn who he is. And as we learn who he is, it's not just to give us this special warm relationship with him. He's designed us, it says in Ephesians, to do good work, to do his service. And that's the last thing I want to talk about. It's just kind of when we follow Jesus, he basically designs us to be used by him. Now it says God uses ordinary people to carry out his extraordinary plan. And that's where I want to go back to these disciples and these apostles and finish kind of walking through with them. Because it's very fascinating to me as I studied, it wasn't their credentials nor their capabilities on which they were chosen. It was their faith. Did they believe on who he was? Did they choose to willingly follow him? In fact, what's neat about them is that if you think about their credentials, none of them, I mean, they were all ordinary people, very ordinary people. There was nothing about them. If Jesus was going to have tryouts, how many of you have ever tried out for something? Either chorus, band, a sports team. Okay, how do they pick you for a tryout? Yeah, what you can do, right? What can you meet some sort of, okay? So Jesus had no tryouts. It wasn't like he talked to the crowd, okay, you 5,000 people, anybody who wants to try out to be my apostle, we're going to come down here, we're going to, you know, measure you on these spiritual disciplines or these character attributes, right? Because what's neat is that we can look at these different apostles, and let's look at some of their character, okay? Let's just pick two or three examples. How about our friend Peter, okay? How many of his qualities were redeeming that you would say basically, wow, that guy's really qualified, right? Cutting off ears, saying, you know, Jesus tells him, Satan, get behind me, right? I mean, he's on the wrong team even. He's scoring baskets on the other bucket, right? Let's talk about Philip, right? So Philip was a little worried about things all the time. He's like, okay, where are we going to get enough food to feed all of these people? I don't get it. It doesn't calculate, right? So, you know, when we talk about their faith or their love for Christ, Christ took them from where they're at, is what I'm trying to explain. So we don't have to clean up our lives to first start following Jesus. That's kind of one of the fallacies I've seen as people come to our church or connect with you. They think, okay, first I got to get my life in order, kind of become more religious and more serious about some of this Christianity stuff, and then I can start following Jesus. That's not the way it worked. Jesus took them from right where they're at and began to train them. Now, he didn't send them out right away, okay? So we'll see. There's a couple of chapters that pass on. So they went through some training before he began to use them. But when he did use them, he used them in some amazing ways. And so the reason why he did that was he wanted to get the glory. So when God uses us as ordinary people, and amazing things happen, when you go to Transnistria, or when you go to Christ's home, or when you're down at the high school, and God does some amazing transformation of someone's life, we know we don't get to take the credit. We're just kind of along watching what happens. Back to my three-year-old helping me set the table. You know, at the end, he's like, yeah, I set the table. But, you know, we realized, no, you really didn't. You know, I had to go back and fix the napkins, and the forks go on the left side. The glasses are all upside down. Right? I mean, so God still goes back and kind of cleans everything up after we think, oh, we've done such a great job being used by him and serving him. So the bottom line is these men were common, everyday, run-of-the-mill people. None of them was rich when they were chosen. None of them was important. He used them where they were at. They had different personalities, different backgrounds, different abilities, different life experiences. I say Jesus was the originator and the designer of diversity. Because if you look at this team, it had, you know, every shape, size, and color of person on it. But Jesus didn't all call the same types of people even. And the same way at our church here is kind of a mosaic of different types of people. God used these 12 apostles to give us kind of a blueprint for how we were going to go and know him and serve him. So just kind of going back to all this, really, what are the things that I would just encourage us that I've chosen for myself to resolve this in 2016? The first thing I resolved to do is follow him with authenticity. Nothing is off limits. So if there's an area of your life that you're worried that he might get into and really cause trouble in your life, bring it up to him now. He'll take care of it. Number two, I resolved to spend time with him and be intimate with him every day, to not miss out. Spend time with him. And lastly, I resolved to be used by him in the lives of others, to be an instrument in his hands. How he wants me to be used, when he wants to be used, where he wants me to use, without any sort of pre-described agenda. I just want to be available for him. And that's my heart for all of us, that we would resolve to follow him in a real way, that we'd want to just be with him. And lastly, we'd want to be used by him and all the privilege that it gives us. Now, let me go back to just one last physical example. In our day and age of GPSs, unfortunately, we've kind of lost the lore of what I call compass. How many people are familiar? Where does the compass always point? North. And now, many of you will explain the magnetism that's involved with that. It's not the true North Pole, okay? Please come back and focus on just the fact that you have a device that is always directed in one direction. And that's our heart's desire here as a church, is that we as a church would always be pointed to Christ. And I want to end with just some lyrics that come from a worship leader named Candy Pearson. It's a song many of you are familiar with. It says, "Give me one pure and holy passion. Give me one magnificent obsession. Give me one glorious ambition for my life." To what? To know and follow hard after you. To know and follow hard after you. To grow as a disciple in your truth. The world is what? Empty, pale, and poor. Compared to knowing you, my Lord, lead me on and I will run after you. Lead me on and I will run after you. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, we thank you that you have a heart for us and that you've called us and that you want us to be followers of you. You want us to be followers with authenticity, people who really have a heart for you but realize the way that our hearts are prone to wander. So Lord, if we have wandered, Lord, may we come back to you. Lord, if we are walking with you, Lord, may you fortify that walk. Lord, as we are just spending time with you, Lord, that you give us joy in our time with you. Help us to just discover more things about you and about ourselves that we can be encouraged and equipped for service. And Lord, as we serve, Lord, may we serve in ways that give you glory. Lord, thank you that you are willing to use us as instruments in your hand for your purposes and your glory. In your name, amen.